family gets together, you play some competitive Candyland, get those marshmallow hearts out, and just curb stomp your 4-year-old cousin. You should have drawn a cinnamon roll if you thought you could get there.
Okay, that's the show opening.
You are now listening to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games. My name is Chris, and I am coming to you from sunny Seattle, Washington. And like I do every single week, I brought an NPC along for the ride with me, coming to us from the frozen tundra of the north. He's NPC Del. Del, how are you doing?
Warm. I'm warm right now. I don't know how long it's going to last.
Do you have a space heater?
Yeah, I got one pointed at me, but it's on full blast and it's kind of rattling a little. I'm not sure it's going to hold out the night.
You need to shovel more coal into it. Of course, we unfortunately are without our trusted ally, NPC Aaron. I imagine, because this episode is coming out on Black Friday, of course, I imagine that he has been waiting in line all week to buy some Black Friday goodies. Because he loves to shop.
He does.
Does he ever? If you want to offer up some moral support to NPC Aaron, who has braved the elements all week to probably buy something he doesn't need, you can do that on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at NPC Aaron. If you want to reach out to me, you can reach me at NPC Chris. Del, what is your Twitter handle?
NPCDEL.
If you want to reach the show, you can also do that. It is at NPC Cast. You can, of course, reach us via Facebook as well. What is the Facebook URL, Del?
It is facebook.com/NPCCast.
It absolutely is. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do that as well. Our email address is thenpccast@gmail.com. All right. So while we are recording this before the holidays, I hope you guys had a wonderful Thanksgiving with your loved ones or shopping or whatever people do on Thanksgiving these days. But today is Black Friday. And to those who aren't in the States, maybe you're overseas or somewhere else, maybe you're even frozen norther than Del, Black Friday is the day after Thanksgiving. Here in the U.S., it has traditionally been the day when Christmas shopping really sort of gets going. Stores offer insane sales. People wait in line literally for weeks. I think I read an article about people waiting in line as early as last Thursday. So over a week, they waited in line to get these awesome, insane deals. It's really a testament to all that is good about America and our want of material objects. Is that pretty fair to say, Del?
That's for very limited values of good. Let's go for zero tramplings this year, America.
Come on. If we pull together, we can do it. This year can be the year that we have zero tramplings. To me, Black Friday is all about the joy of competition. The time for giving thanks is over. And now it is time for blood. And so on today's episode, we're going to be talking about playing games competitively. Now, you may say that, Chris, Del, this is sort of going against the spirit of NPC Cast. NPC Cast is about positivity. It's about fun. It's about enjoying games with friends. While true, we also all sort of believe that there is more than one way to have fun in games, and that everyone's definition of what they consider fun should be considered as a valid definition. Is that pretty fair to say, Del?
Yeah. Mark Rosewater has a great series of articles about the psychographics of players and how players get their fun. And there are clear demarcations between people who play for the joy of assembling a cool combo and people who play to win because they find competition intellectually stimulating and that's what they enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we're going to go through this episode, and we're going to talk about some of those elements, the elements that make up competitive players, and sort of dive into it. Now, some of this will be a little bit, what's the word? Controversial. That being said, I want everyone to go at this with sort of an open mind as to what competitive gaming is really, really about. So we recognize the idea of competitive gaming, not necessarily for everyone, but there's a large population of the gaming populace that does enjoy the idea of playing games to win games. In fact, I know that Dell is sort of obviously an MTG enthusiast, but he enjoys the tournament scene. And that's one of your competitive outlets, if I'm not mistaken, correct, Dell?
Yeah, that's I got a couple PTQs lined up, and I'm going to Vancouver in January.
I remember the last PTQ that I participated in, me and you actually had a feature match, right?
That's true. We were featured in each other's eyes because we were sitting across from each other.
Right. I mean, they didn't have a camera crew there, but I mean, they didn't need to say it. They said it without really saying it. It went without being said, but I feel like ours was the feature match because I too have enjoyed playing competitive Magic in the past. I don't play as much anymore. I was literally looking at deck lists today because I'm thinking about getting back into it, but I held off. But other games that I sort of enjoy the idea of competitive play would be War Machine. And I know that Aaron, if he was here, would agree with me. I think War Machine is a great game. It has a great competitive scene. And it's the type of game that really is conducive to competitive play. What elements does a game have to have, in your opinion, Dell, for it to be considered a good competitive game?
I think the number one thing it needs to have is a clear vertical slice sort of beginning, middle, and end to a specific session. Whereas with a game like Battlestar Galactica that can be drawn out, even though there are, you know, versus elements, it can be drawn out or compacted as much as possible. Whereas with a tabletop war game, everybody's racing towards destroy the other units as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely one of like the main things I think about when I think of a competitive game. You know, in my opinion, competitive games are ones in which the best competitive games are ones in which the players start on even footing. Now, you know, there's some circumstances where you have like a little bit of asymmetry. For example, in the game War Machine, you know, there's different armies that you can play. Or in Magic the Gathering, there's different decks that you can play.
In chess, the white pieces go first.
Exactly. In chess, the white pieces go first. That's a good point. But at the end of the day, those asymmetries are available to both players. I mean, I might go to a Magic tournament, but I am, in theory, playing out of the same deck pool or pool of cards that everyone else is playing out of. Whether or not my choice of deck is the same as theirs, you know, is another issue. And we'll talk a little bit about those considerations later. But overall, we started from the same place. The antithesis of that, and, you know, in sort of researching today's topic, it came up was the idea of MMOs, massively multiplayer games. And I'm going to use this because it's the most specific example. But in a massively multiplayer game, it's very possible that the person who you are playing, like let's say you're doing some player versus player, the person that you're fighting may just have better gear than you because they have more time to play, they've been playing longer, they've gotten luckier with when it comes to loot drops and those sorts of things. So those games from the onset are a little bit hindered in being a truly, you know, truly accurate test of skill in that, you know, the person who's been playing longer has, you know, a strict material advantage, even, you know, possibly greater than their experience advantage. So when you're looking at games, I think it's important to sort of have an eye towards games that are a little bit are easily able to be competitive in nature. Obviously, games such as Apples to Apples, where there's going to be arbitrary sort of rules in place, maybe not so much a competitive game, right? Cards Against Humanity, maybe not the best game to like go to a tournament for. I don't know. I'm sure there are them. But obviously the game is not designed in that function. And this extends also to, you know, games that are created, you know, without the designer sort of thinking about them as competitive games, games that aren't tuned that way. We talk a lot about, you know, War Machine obviously here, but you know, the other really popular, actually worldwide more popular miniatures game is Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000 by Games Workshop. And in our opinion, at least on this show, those games to us feel like they are a little bit that tailored more for the casual player. And this is actually, you know, repeated in the way that the designers of those games, you know, describe their games. They describe their games as beer and pretzel games. So their intent while making this game is not to make something that is designed to be played competitively. And so oftentimes you can have sort of degenerate tactics that are pop up, which also we'll talk about a little bit later on. It's not necessarily a bad thing, or not even necessarily an indicator of a horrible competitive game. It's just something to think about when you're thinking about what you actually want to devote time into getting really good at. So Del, let's talk a little bit about common elements that really competitive players have. And first and foremost, while I was crafting these show notes, I leaned heavily on a book called Playing to Win by a man by the name of David Serlin. It's available for free at serlin.net. David Serlin is also the creator of a game called Yomi, which is a board game that you may or may not have heard of. It's a Japanese word that is actually used in the book Playing to Win, because Yomi is the concept of sort of planning what your opponent is going to do and reacting before they do it, so kind of thinking ahead. And then, of course, it goes into levels where it's like, you know, I think that Dell is going to do this, but Dell also probably thinks that I think he's going to do this, so then I'm probably going to, you know, and you obviously get layers and layers of thought that go into that.
I've seen this game.
Yeah. We actually have it in the store. It's pretty popular. I mean, it sells reasonably well. And so shout out to David Serlin for putting together this, because, you know, as we went through this, I gleaned a lot of our ideas, concepts from there. But the first element of a really competitive player that I want to talk about is that a competitive player has a will to win at all costs. Now, with the caveat, of course, being, you know, all tournament legal costs.
And sometimes, like Alex Bertoncini, even past that.
He recently like top 8ed or top 16 to a Star City event.
Yeah, last weekend. Yeah, he said that in his little player slice that Wizards did, he said his favorite card in the most misunderstood card in Legacy, in his opinion, was the card Explore.
Yeah. So hopefully I'm all for second chances. So hopefully he's learned his lesson. But that being said, there's definitely a will to win with when it comes to competitive players. This often is sort of confusing to people who aren't of a competitive mindset. And the main reason being is that the concepts of, you know, cheesy tactics or unfair tactics or, you know, degenerate decks or, you know, cheesy, you know, army building strategies are sort of thrown out the window by a lot of competitive players. Magic has, you know, a billion cards to choose from, right? But there's still a segment of the Magic playing community that, you know, if you show up to a tournament and your deck is a carbon copy of the deck that won the latest Star City Open, a lot of players sort of look down on players that do that net decking. But to a competitive player, I mean, that's just part of the process. Like, if you're not trying to use every advantage that you can within the scope of the tournament rules to win, then you're not really trying your hardest. So, Del, you have a reputation among our playgroup for being a little bit of a hard ass when it comes to min-maxing and using every advantage you can. Can you tell us a little bit about that mindset and sort of how you feel about that mindset.
Yeah, as far as competitive games, things like Ticket to Ride or Bridge or Magic, you're not my friend until after the game is over and we shake hands and then we go get beer. Until, you know, from the start, from the opening bell until the closing bell, you're my enemy, and I'm going to defeat you using every tactic I have available. And I'm lucky that I'm able to turn that on and off and be friendly before and after. But that's definitely a thing that goes through my mind, is I need to crush this person to prove that I'm better. You know, that's how the tournaments go.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that you can do that in a way that's not necessarily unpleasant. The issue that comes into play is these gray areas. For example, if you look at a game like War Machine, okay, there may be a handful of armies that are sort of, you know, those top tier armies. And there's and from those top tier armies, there's a handful of casters that are considered like really strong casters. E. Haley is a great example. She has probably the best feat in all of War Machine. And so because of that, she's used in a lot of lists. Like people sort of, you know, if you're playing Signar, like she's going to be one of the casters that you're going to take into battle with you because she's very, very good. So people get flack, you know, for using this very popular caster because, you know, she happens to be good, but there's sort of this unwritten code that players have that they sort of ascribe to other players in that, oh, well, you know, she's a cheesy caster. You know, everyone uses her, so, you know, I'm not going to use her. Or everyone uses her, so shame on you for using her too. And that's when you sort of get into this disconnect. And that's really what you have to understand about competitive players, is that there's nothing keeping you from, you know, using these tactics over and over again until someone can, you know, come up with a counter for it.
The example I always go to is football. When, if you have Calvin Johnson on your team, you know, if you have Megatron, you know, lining up in the wideout position, and you can throw to him and no one can cover him, you just keep throwing to him until they, you know, it might be cheap, but at the end of the day, you have more points and the game is over and you've won. And a win is a win. If they think it's cheap, then the correct answer is get a better cornerback and put someone up who can cover Megatron, or I'm just going to keep scoring on you using Calvin Johnson.
And Sirlin talks in his game, you know, his actual competitive background is from fighting games. That's where he sort of got his start, and that's what he chose to focus on, you know, focus his competitive talents into. And he said that, you know, the thing that he was known for was he was incredibly patient, and he was willing to do the same move 100 times in a row. Because if he could do it 100 times in a row and you're not going to figure out a counter for it, he's just going to win that way. That's just, it's part of the game. It's built into the game. Maybe the designers didn't intend for that move to be used 100 times in a row, but it's not up to the players to sort of determine what the designer's intent was when they're playing to win the game. They're going to use any tactic they can within the scope of the rules to succeed. And so I read recently a 10 commandments of the commander format for Magic the Gathering. And a lot of them were really arbitrary. It's like, oh, you know, thou shall not use land destruction or whatever, something like that. And it's like, well, that's sort of, what is that saying? Like, what if I'm a player who enjoys using land destruction? It's not like illegal, you know, it's not against the rules. Why can't I do that? If that's what, you know, is fun for me, why are you taking that away from me because of some, you know, implied contract that should exist between players that isn't explicitly stated anywhere? You know, part of the mindset that allows for competitive games to exist is the fact that the rules have to be very explicit. you have to have a game that has very well-defined rules. And when you start bringing in arbitrary ones where it's like, you know, you shouldn't use an exact copy of a deck that you saw online when you're playing Magic, then it's like, who's the police of that? And that's sort of, again, this is the mindset of those really competitive players. I personally, I like to come up with decks that are a little bit not normal, you know, but I go into that with the assumption that, hey, my deck, I'm going to be creative with it. I'm going to use it as a creative outlet. I'm going to build something cool that I think is fun to play for me. But I go into that not expecting to win every game. I know that my deck hasn't been forged in the fires of the internet and played a million times on Magic the Gathering Online. So it's something that is needs to be kind of addressed, is that competitive players have a will to win at any tournament legal cost. And that's something that should be sort of understood. And you know, I argue that it should be accepted if that's what their intent is. Now, another thing that sort of binds competitive players together, and again, these are things that, regardless of the game that they choose to be competitive in, you know, these are traits that competitive players will have, is a desire to go beyond knowledge of the game. And this is where you get into the concept of the metagame. So, Del, to people who aren't really familiar with the term, can you explain what the term metagame means?
A metagame is using your knowledge of what other people who are competitive will probably be doing to develop a plan to counter that. To use that football example again, if you know that the read option offense is getting more and more popular, then even though you don't run it, you need to think about it and have a counter for it ready in your defensive playbook, even though it's something that you may or may not encounter.
Right. And the metagame is what typically, you know, unless the tactic is just completely degenerate and then it requires, you know, outside assistance. But the metagame is usually what will keep most of the strategies in a game sort of in check. Because the fact of the matter is if, you know, let's say a mono black devotion deck is, you know, sweeping all the tournaments and just doing amazing, eventually people are going to pick up on this. Like, wow, this mono black devotion deck is really good. And the vast majority of players will start using it and playing with it until eventually someone's like, well, hey, if I go to a tournament, I can expect that 60 to 70% of the field is going to be playing mono black devotion. So if I make my deck very good against mono black devotion, then I have an advantage in 60 to 70% of my matches. And that's sort of a metagame choice, predicting what other people are going to do, researching what has been popular, what are the popular strategies and these kind of things. And that's very important in sort of going into a game with a competitive mindset, is being willing to, you know, learn as much as you can about the game, consume as much as you can about the game outside of simply just practicing. You know, that's why, you know, you have football players who go into the film room and they'll watch tape on all the teams that they're going to play because they're trying to learn a little bit about what those teams are doing. And that's part of the metagame. It's the game outside of the game itself.
Now, I want to point out something you said there that I think some people might have missed. When you talked about making a metagame deck choice, one of the things that competitive players do is they don't play their favorite deck. You know, I have a favorite deck, but I don't get to play that deck all the time. I play the deck that is best situated. And competitive players don't get attached to flavor. They don't get attached to ideals. They get attached to what's the most effective. And so you'll find players who may personally like playing, you know, Marvel characters in their HeroClix games, but if, you know, the new Superman figure has a great dial, they're going to be playing Superman in their next tournament play, even if casually they have an awesome Hulk Wolverine team up.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, your point also inspired another point for me. I'll counter you with another point. What Del says is absolutely true. You know, if you look at, like, the let's say the national metagame, right? So we look at this past weekend's results, the Grand Prix that just happened in Magic the Gathering this past weekend. I can look in there and say, okay, what are the top 16 decks that appeared, you know, in this tournament and sort of gauge. It's like, okay, people are playing mono blue devotion. They're playing mono black devotion decks. And there's a smattering of red white soldiers as well, or something, whatever. Now, that is a metagame of a large tournament with, you know, coverage and sort of a lot of pro players are playing in it. Now, that metagame might be vastly different if you go to your local FNM at the comic book store and you're playing against the same, you know, 10, 12, 20 players that are there every week. That store will have its own metagame that is just exclusive to that. You know, if it's often sort of seen that pro Magic players will tend to pick decks that really allow them to make a lot of decisions. The idea being that the more decisions that they can make correctly, the better their chances of winning. So they'll skew, you know, away from decks that are involved, that are a little bit more random, that are more like risk-reward type decks. But if your Friday Night Magic is full of a bunch of aggressive players who love playing aggro decks, then that metagame will be a lot different than if you were to go to a national, you know, pro tournament for Magic or a GP. So that's something to consider, is that, you know, metagame is very, very dependent. If I'm always playing Dell, and I know that Dell will always play a black deck because he loves black decks, then that's as far as my metagame needs to go. All I need to do is find a deck that will be a black deck, and I'm good to go. So the metagame can expand. It can be as... I just said expand really weird. The metagame can expand. It can be, you know, worldwide, or it can be your local game store. It can be the three guys that you play Commander with every weekend. The one other friend in the country that plays the same minis game that you play.
That's not subtle anymore.
but right. So I'm sure that Dell and that guy talk a lot about their metagame being the only two players that play that game. But so that's something to consider. Thank you for reminding me about that, Dell. The other element of really competitive players is that they tend to fix the little things. They tend to find the holes in their game and fix the little things. And along with that is you'll find that the people who are very serious about being competitive players in their chosen game have a astounding memory for the way that their games have played out. Because in order to improve themselves, they have to know, like, okay, you know, game three of round four of that tournament, I was matched, you know, I played this when I should have done this, you know, and they have to remember those things so that, you know, in practice, when they, you know, eventually see that situation again, they can react differently. So they take, a lot of times they'll take very good notes. You'll see, you know, people oftentimes will publish their tournament reports, but a lot of people just have, you know, journals that they keep tournament reports in just for their private use. You know, one of the things that they say about poker is that if you really want to get good at poker, take a notepad with you and just keep track of, you know, the hands that you're playing, how often you win with them, you know, what hands tend to beat you, those types of things. Not just so you gather information about the players that you're playing with, but you're gathering information about your own habits and can fix those little holes in your game. Has there ever been points, Dell, in your either Magic playing career or any other sort of competitive game where there was something that you did over and over again and then until you finally realized that you did it all the time?
I know I'm bad at mulliganing in Magic. And I'm always trying to, I'll draw sample hands in between rounds and ask input on other people and see if I can get better at it or whether or not they would keep it.
Really good players in whatever their field are going to be ones who are going to learn from their mistakes and fix the little things, you know. It's not about, you know, between every match you don't have to, you know, totally overhaul your entire strategy. But it's like, oh, you know, maybe there I should not have gone for the assassination. You know, recently I was playing a War Machine game. I was way ahead. I was playing with Aurora, who is a Convergence Warcaster who is very fast, and she has an insane threat range. She can travel across, you know, all the way across the table and try to assassinate their enemy caster. And I was well ahead. Like, I was just in total control of the game. But I saw my opportunity, and I went for the long-range caster kill, and I failed, and I ended up losing that game. And so that was something that I was like, okay, next time I have to be more patient. Like I have to just, you know, when I feel like I'm ahead, I just have to keep consistent instead of going for the quick, you know, turn two kill or whatever. So that's something to think about is, you know, analyze the games that you're playing and see, you know, where your trends tend to go and the mistakes you tend to make and try to fix those little things. Now, this entire time we've been talking about a wide variety of mediums. And, you know, when we were going into this show, originally I was like, hey, you know, I pitched the idea. I was like, hey, we should do a show about like competitive play. And obviously, you know, it's like Magic the Gathering is a very big competitive circuit, has a lot of pro players. War Machine has a pretty big tournament scene. And that was sort of it. That was as far as like, you know, our knowledge went. But one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we highlighted on was the fact that there's elements of strategy and there's elements of good competitive play that crosses all genres of competitive games. You know, I've already mentioned Playing to Win by David Serlin, who got his start as a pro Street Fighter player. But then he goes and, you know, designs a game like Yomi, a board game. A lot of his book is sort of talks about, you know, Magic the Gathering. He talks about a wide variety of different things, talks about chess. Because there's elements and there's sort of ideas that permeate all these different types of competitive activities. One of the best things I've ever seen when it comes to how to think like a competitive player is a daily by Day9, who, if you guys don't know, is a StarCraft shoutcaster, basically. He used to be a pro player, but now he just does commentary and stuff. He has an insanely popular daily video series that he does. Even though I wasn't playing StarCraft, I would always check it out because esports to me are very, when they're, you know, covered in a way that is compelling and they're covered by compelling personalities, I like watching them just as I would like watching, you know, sports that I don't follow necessarily, because you can kind of, you have someone there to hold your hand and break down what's happening and tell you why something is so amazing and whatnot. But if you get the chance to, and I'll link it in the show notes, his daily number 400 is like amazing. And I stopped what I was doing and I wrote him an email and said, you know, at the time I was playing Magic competitively. And I said, thank you for making this. I know it's about StarCraft and I know that's where, you know, your background is. But just so you know, like as someone who's, you know, playing in Magic tournaments, this daily was just amazing. Like the information that you're giving is just phenomenal. And the way that he sort of breaks down how a competitive player thinks about games was just phenomenal. And that's the kind of core of what I wanted to focus on in this episode is the fact that if chess is your thing or Magic is your thing or War Machine is your thing or Candyland is your thing, even though it shouldn't be, let's be fair. But if it is, you know, there's elements of strategy that apply across a wide variety of those games. One of the most famous Magic articles of all time, and Dell would argue that it's the best Magic article of all time, is an article by Mr. Mike Flores called Who is the Beatdown? Dell, can you explain a little bit about Who is the Beatdown? I know you haven't memorized.
So the article is set back in 1999, and it's Mike Flores talking about Red Deck Wins versus Sly, who are similar but not identical decks. And it's about recognizing when you should be on the attack and when you should be playing the control side. I think it's actually applicable to a lot more than just Magic, and it reminds me honestly a lot of Machiavelli's The Prince, which I highly recommend reading. It's really good and really easy to read even now. But yeah, the article basically outlines the idea of how to play aggressively and when to play aggressively and gives you tips on recognizing when in the game your role has shifted from the beatdown to the control.
Right. And the reason I mentioned that specifically is that in Serlin's book, he starts to break down some of the Art of War by Sun Tzu. And one of Sun Tzu's five, I guess, keys of war is he will win who knows when to fight and when not to fight. And this is 500 BC when this was written. Basically, he's saying, who's the beatdown? Like Mike Flores channeled Sun Tzu in that article, because those fundamental things about strategy, about military strategy, come into play so often in games. And, you know, even I just, you know, said my example about my War Machine game. If I would have sat back and said, wait a minute, who's the aggressor here? You know, what is the position right now, and analyze the game state, I might have played a little bit differently. You know, the idea of when it's okay, when you want to attack and when you want to defend is paramount in so many games. You know, and any game with strategy is going to have those times when those choices are coming to play. Another example, and this is one that, you know, we've already touched on a little bit, was the idea of you know, of applying these strategies and tactics to American football, is the idea that in football you want to control the line of scrimmage. The center of, you know, your offense, the center of your defense is where you want to control that. You want to dictate how the line of scrimmage is going to behave. In the same way that center control in chess is incredibly important, you know, making sure that you have sort of control over the four squares in the center of the chessboard is incredibly important, and it's oftentimes sort of what can turn a game in someone else's favor. You know, when you see that games, no matter what sort of level they're at, are going to have these core elements that are going to kind of stick with them. You know, a game like Magic that has, you know, incremental card advantage, the idea that cards are a resource that, you know, should be used and it should be sort of monitored, and the idea that drawing an extra card is oftentimes as good as, you know, destroying one of their cards, that's something that can apply to other games as well. I mean, when you talk about, again, you know, football, you talk about time of possession, right? Like, not only are you trying to score points, but even just keeping the clock running when you're ahead, you know, getting those advantages, keeping your defense off the field for as long as possible, when you're ahead, those types of resources are going to be in other games as well, where it's like you're not always looking at the victory points. Sometimes you got to look at, you know, the cards that you have in your hand, or, you know, the cards that are left in the deck. All sorts of things you have to kind of keep track of when you're thinking about these things. The cool thing about this line of thinking is that once you start looking into what competitive players do and the tools that they use in getting really good at their craft, you can start applying those tools in that line of thinking to whatever you decide you want to be good at and whatever you decide you want to play. So, Del, what is some of the things, what are some of the tools that we have at our disposal to get better as players in whatever game we choose to be good at?
I got three right off the bat I can give you. Right. That's practice.
Practice?
Yes.
Not a game. It's not the game that I bleed for and sacrifice. No, we're talking about practice. Allen Iverson would disagree, but that's okay.
Yeah,
practice, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, gold fishing and Magic, you know, just taking up, like I said earlier with my mulligan example, just, you know, drawing opening hands over and over and trying to decide if they're keepers or not and why, gold fishing them out. You know, just seeing the same thing over and over and over and making the right play decision or not. And I will say, if you're going to practice, you know, you don't have to put together a professional team. You know, you're not going to go and try and defeat the USSR at the Olympic Games and bring the trophy back to America. But just,
you
know,
the Settlers of Catan trophy.
Yeah, exactly. But you do need to have, you know, someone who also wants to get better to drive you and to yell at you when you make an incorrect decision and, you know, call you out if you're falling into the old traps. And this is true of, you know, literally any activity. You know, have somebody there who also wants to get good, and then help them out too. You know, you always want to help the other person achieve the gains they're looking for, and you want to do the same thing and have them help you. It's, yeah, you know, it's super simple. You know, we've been doing it in every sport and leisure activity since we invented them.
Right. And one of the key things too, you know, beyond getting people that, you know, can sort of pick apart what you're doing wrong, is that you want to have those people that, like Doug was saying earlier, you know, that you can say, hey, this is the hand I drew. This is the hand I was playing that game. You know, would you have kept this hand? Would you mulligan here? Like, because oftentimes, you know, once you're able to sort of identify what the holes in your game are, people can help you with those. And then, you know, you return the favor. For example, if someone, you know, tends to be overly aggressive, you know, Dell could say, hey, Chris, you know, I watched that game and, you know, maybe if here you weren't so aggressive, maybe you keep your guys back and you shoot for an extra turn instead of trying to initiate close combat or whatever it is. You know, it's good to have those people to bounce those ideas off of. The other thing about practice that I'll say, and I actually learned about this a little bit while I was, you know, looking into people who play test their own games and what really works is the idea that when you're going through this, you know, these practice sessions, go into it already having a mind, being mindful of what the perceived sort of problems are going to be, and practice with a purpose. You know, go into it, say, hey, like, I'm really bad at figuring out when to mulligan in limited. So, you know, today when I'm going to play some drafts online, and I'm going to be really mindful and really focus on, you know, fixing that one little thing that I want to fix and sort of find those elements that you can just sort of get better at. You know, when you're practicing for a big tournament, if you know how your local metagame is going to shape out and you know that everyone's going to be playing aggressive decks, when you're practicing, practice against, you know, aggressive decks and with the mindset that I'm going to try to get better. How do I fix this matchup? How do I get better if I'm going to a Hive tournament and I know that I'm going to be, you know, switching between white and black, and I know that when I play white, I win a lot more often than when I play black. Play a lot of black, you know, try out the other color. See, fix those little holes in your game when you're practicing, and it helps so much. The other thing is, because metagame is such a big thing about competitive play, read articles, stay up to date, like just take as much information as you can in. You know, some games are fortunate enough to have coverage. You know, Magic the Gathering, a good example of a game that, you know, you can find videos online of people playing games of Magic and sort of break those down. But kind of stay up to date on what the current, you know, best players are doing.
And don't be discouraged if you try reading about something and it's just unreadable or makes no sense or isn't enjoyable. Pick someone else. There are certain Magic authors that I cannot tolerate reading. They're just ghastly. They're not good at their job. But there are others that are really great, and I read what they write every week when it comes out because they are fantastic and have a lot of insight, and I can get where they're coming from. So don't give up if the first thing you read is not interesting or helpful, because there is somebody else who is writing at a level that you're going to appreciate, whether it's an intro level or a very high level.
And the other thing too is you know, when it comes to finding people that are on your level, is participate in you know, internet forum discussions. If you can find forums, I mean there's a billion forums that you can find up anywhere. I'm sure there's a forum in the game that you're into. But find those people and sort of engage with them. In the same way that obviously when you're putting together a group of players to practice with, you want to find people who are kind of like-minded and have the same, you know, passion for, you know, the game as you do. If you don't have those people nearby, go to forums. Find people online that have that same passion. Because even, you know, talking about game strategies and stuff like that online is gonna help you immensely.
I have one more piece of advice, and it's something that's helped me immensely in my bridge game back when I was into bridge. Try and only play above your level. You know, always punch up. You know, you don't learn anything when you set up a bridge hand and a dummy hand against your 7-year-old cousin. She doesn't know what she's doing. It's not helping you learn. You want to play against people who are better than you and have them bring you up to their level of competition.
So yeah, that's basically the gist of it. Now, here's the thing, right? Like, you know, I play games competitively occasionally. Dell plays Magic competitively. We're not pros. But for us, and I'll speak for myself, and then I'll let Dell have a chance to explain his two cents, for me, when I go to a tournament, I don't go there with the intent to win the tournament. I go with the intent to do as well as I possibly can, because there's something about breaking a game down so finely and, you know, so into such small segments and really trying to, like, understand how a game works that is very, very intriguing to me. You know, me and Aaron have talked about it before, where sometimes there's games out there that just scratch our competitive itch. And that competitive itch is the desire to just know something as well as we possibly can know it. And I think that for us, trying to be good competitive players and trying to get in that competitive mindset isn't ultimately for us about winning every game we play and just in destroying and becoming professional, you know, Carcassonne players, whatever. It's about, I want to know this thing as well as I possibly can, because it's fun to know it. It's fun to have that knowledge. It's fun to go into a book on Scrabble and memorize all 102 two-letter Scrabble words.
There are 74 two-letter Scrabble words.
There's more than that. There's at least 102, because I memorized 102 of them. I digress. But for me, that's sort of what draws me to it. Is I don't play competitively to win. I play competitively because it's fun to do sometimes with certain games. Dell, what are your thoughts? I'll let you get the last word. Like O'Reilly, you get the last word.
I do go into every tournament expecting to win. With the exception of one PTQ back in 2002, that hasn't been the case at the highest level. But the just glad to be here mentality, that doesn't sit right with me. You need a killer instinct. When you look at professional football players, none of them are just glad to be here. They all want to win. And I think that's a important mindset to try and get into, and to also know when to get out of. There are very competitive games that I'm very serious about, and there is apples to apples, and there is role-playing games, Knights Black Agents, where you're working as a team, not trying to win, but to have the most fun. The joke is, whoever has the most fun wins is only true until there's prize support on the line. So that's my take, is I want to win everything when it's a competitive tournament. And if I'm scrubbing out, if I'm already in the X2 block and I'm not in prize contention, then I'll ease up. Then once I'm out and I'm just playing for points and pride, then I'm happy to have more fun and be more relaxed. But playing at that high level is such a rush that there's nothing like it. There's nothing like cruising and doing well and, you know, having made the right choices earlier so that your later choices are easier. It's really great. I can't recommend being competitive enough.
All right. So on that note, we will get to the things that we are excited about, and we will do that right now. On to the what we are excited about portion of the show. I will go ahead and start. This week, I'm excited about an RPG, a sci-fi RPG specifically, that first came to my attention via email. Some people hit up the NPC Cast email and let me know that this was coming out, which is great. If you have something that's coming out, I love to read email. So please send me all that stuff. I can't promise that I'll always get to it, but keep sending it though. But this RPG is now up on Kickstarter, actually. It is called Redemption. It's a project by Paul Frack. They're currently almost halfway to their goal with about 24 days left.
They're about 1,363 thousandths of the way there.
What?
They're about 1,363 of the 3,000ths of the way there.
Yeah, I'm sure you could like break that fraction down a little bit more. But I mean, there's no time. Anyways, so it's pretty interesting. I downloaded the beta actually. If you go to their actual website, The full beta rules are on there currently, so you can download them as a PDF and check them out. Relatively interesting system. At first glance, I mean, my first question to them was sort of, what makes your game different?
Oh, man. They got mass combat rules?
Yes, they do. In fact, one of the things that when they got back to me about what was different was the idea that they wanted to have mass combat rules that played very similar to the way that all the other rules play in their game. So, for example, they have three different scales of combat. They have space combat, battlefield combat, and firefight combat. They all use the same sort of mechanics, and the difficulty of doing things changes depending on what scale you're going at. For example, if you are at space scale and you have, like, you know, you're in giant ships and you're trying to, like, you know, do huge space battles, and then you bring those ships into atmosphere and you begin to, you know, fight on a battlefield level, you know, those things are a little bit easier. But if you're in a firefight, you know, scale, and you, it's just you with a gun and you're trying to, like, take on an army of men, it's going to be more difficult for you. So it does let you sort of mix the scales, but the idea is that, you know, it always is sort of the same basic system. You have a target number that you're trying to roll under, that target number never changes. So your stats, your skills, gear modifiers you have all factor into that target number. You're trying to get under them by rolling a set of dice. How difficult it is determines what dice you roll. For example, if you're rolling an easy roll, it's 3d6. Standard is 3d8. Hard is 3d10. So your dice pool changes based on how difficult the action is, but your target number never changes. So it's a very simple, clean way of dealing that. There's not a lot of adding numbers and factoring stuff. You always have the same sort of things you're trying to go for. The really cool thing mechanically, though, I liked about it was they bring in the idea of tags. So tags are sort of like what Fate uses, and a lot of games actually at this point use them. But tags are basically descriptors that explain, you know, something about your character, and you can then use those tags during gameplay to, you know, get benefits at specific times. The cool thing, though, is there's also group tags. So your party has tags that it uses as well to sort of define it. So it has a lot of camaraderie built into the way that the character creation works. So it looks super cool. I want to thank Eric for sending me the info, but definitely check it out. The other thing, and I'm looking at this screenshot right now of the Redemption RPG Kickstarter that reminded me, is there is a set of rules in place that looks pretty cool. I haven't got all the way through it, but it's in the beta rules on how to build equipment. And it's a super malleable system in that you can sort of build any equipment you can imagine, any technology that you can imagine can be built with sort of a point system. So it looks pretty sweet.
Yeah, I have not been shy about saying that space naval combat is basically my dream genre. So if this game is awesome, and it does look awesome, then I am 10,000% in favor of it.
Yeah, I mean, I have the beta rules, and so I want to check it out and see. But it looks cool, and the Kickstarter is well put together. They have some cool rewards there, so definitely check it out, and see if it's your thing. And on that note, Del, what are you excited about this week?
I will tell you what my thing is. My thing is the excitement that I'm having running the Edge of the Empire campaign that we've been playing in for a little bit now. Yeah. I'm really starting to get a handle on how to use the advantages and despairs and triumphs and disadvantages that the game throws at you using the dice system. I am super enthused about this game. This is the first adventure that's really not from any published material that the party is sort of creating themselves, and it is really awesome. I'm going to be writing a couple blogs on npccast.com
yes.
about my thoughts about them.
I gave you blogging permission, right?
Yes, you did give me permission with a note not to be a jerk.
Right. So I'm just warning all of our frequenters of our blog. Dell now has the keys to the blog, so just be warned.
But yeah, the party is exploring a Golan space platform ostensibly owned by the rebels, and hopefully everything works out fine and they'll be able to find who's dealing Glitterstim out of that without incident.
Because that's how RPGs work, and I'm sure that's what will happen.
Yeah, just completely without incident. Yep, it was that guy. We're done. Cool. Yeah. Let's go drink some blue milk.
Yeah.
But I'll be blogging more about it. I'm also kind of excited to get back into writing about games. It's been a while since I wrote any sort of articles, so it's going to be good to get back into it, get in that habit, and start bringing more of the table to you.
Yeah. So there you go. Obviously, Aaron is going to be pretty tight-lipped. He's probably excited about whatever he's waiting in line for Black Friday. I'm just kidding. He's not actually waiting in line for anything. If you have been listening to this show on iTunes, first of all, thank you. Second of all, you can, of course, subscribe to the show. We appreciate it. If you would feel so inclined, you can write a review. No matter how many stars you want to give us, write the review. We crave feedback. It's what helps us stay competitive in the podcasting market, is that feedback, fixing those little things that we do horribly, horribly wrong every single episode. And not to mention, if you give us a 5-star review, Dell will read it in a voice of your choosing, which is always hilarious, good times, fun for the entire family. If you are listening on Stitcher Radio, like NPC Aaron is right now, you can, of course, give us a thumbs up. A plus sign will add us to your list of favorites, and those all help us get into the Stitcher algorithm, which then shoots us out into the ears of other people listening to podcasts like ours. So that's a big help. But Dell, there is one thing, truly only one thing we really ask of our listeners, and that is what, Dell?
To tell a human, your opponent at the next tournament you're at,
yes,
that you're at the top table because you listen to the best podcast on the air.
Right, exactly. And
also
actually,
the NPC cast.
Yeah, you listen to two podcasts, the good one and us. But also it helps sort of when you beat someone very badly, say, hey, you know what? I'm sorry I beat you. As a consolation prize, let me hip you to the game. And I'm just going to slide over a napkin, you know, that says NPC cast on it. They'll get the note. He'll do the research. He'll figure it out. But it helps us out so much. And really, we wouldn't be where we are today, which is not very much anywhere, really. But but we wouldn't even be there if it wasn't for the word of mouth that we're getting. We appreciate all of that. And it's so cool when we get feedback from people that none of us know. And it's all because of you guys telling your friends. So that's a very, very good thing. Dell, should we give them a Goyf Watch update?
I think it's important because of what the Goyf is at right now.
Oh my gosh! Don't tell me. I don't want to know what it is.
Okay, I'll just
really quick.
All right.
So Goyf Watch is a bet that me and Dell made way back. I don't even remember what episode it was.
It was when Modern Masters came out.
Right when Modern Masters came out, me and Dell made a little wager, a friendly wager, completely legal and on the up and up. And what we wagered was that Dell predicted that the price of a Tarmogoyf would increase when Modern Masters came out due to an increased demand, an increased fervor for the format. I, on the other hand, said no. Increased supply means that it will stay the same or lower. Now, we gave ourselves a little bit of buffer, but the idea was that if Tarmogoyf, the card, the magic card, reached an average value on TCG Player of $129.99 or less, Dell would buy me a Tarmogoyf. If it is at $130 or more, I will buy Dell a Tarmogoyf. And this is all based on what the price is on Christmas Day. So, Dell, we're about a month out. What is the price at right now?
That's my drum roll. It's not very good.
Yeah. No, I could tell.
It is at $130 exactly.
Oh my god. It's so close.
At a certain point, what you need to do is just buy the $140 Tarmogoyf that's on there for yourself.
Yeah.
That'll drop the average price.
It's literally to the penny. It could not be closer. Oh my gosh. Okay, well.
So everyone go out. If you want to help NPC Chris, buy the Tarmogoyfs that are less than $130 to drive the average price down.
Buy all the overpriced ones, basically.
Yes.
Oh, wow. That was closer than I thought it was going to be. Cool. Well, thanks for that, Del. That is pretty close, and we'll give you an update on that.
As it gets closer.
Also, when we started this podcast, we thought we were going to do it in, like, seasons, and we were going to do, like, 50-episode chunks. You know, we started the first podcast came out very first week of this year. We're on episode 48 now, which is very cool. We got about 12 times farther than I thought we would get. We were going to stop at 50 and then take a couple weeks off, but then we decided no, we won't, because at the end of this year, we are going to give our NPC Cast approved top 10 list of games that came out this year, and then we will also the following week have a sort of State of the Union / New Year's resolutions for the NPC Cast. So I just want to hype those a little bit. Be on the lookout for those. They will be coming out later this year. And yeah, stop listening to this and go buy presents for your family members. On that note, you can add 1,000 XP to your character sheets, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye. NPC Cast is written by Chris, Dell, and Aaron. You can reach us on Twitter at twitter.com/NPCcast or by email at thenpccast@gmail.com. As always, support your local game store.